and it was great. It was sort of, I mean, I had a hard time singing it, to be honest, in the studio because it was so different from what I expected, but I love it. And so I was really happy with the way it turned out on my CD. And I realized that I needed to have a video of some kind out there just because so many people are video oriented. And so, my friend Leonardo Cuevas, who's a wonderful photographer who took, all the pictures, on my CD, had a brand new camera that did really, really fast, shutter speeds. And given the imagery of the song talks about, you know, how can you keep away from rolling with the tide and all sort of natural images. We talked about it and we were like, you know, that would be an ideal thing for just a whole series of fast motion pictures. And there's a beach just north of Malibu that you're allowed to bring your dogs on, which I love to go to and bring my dogs whenever I can. And so Leo and I went up there one day with my roommate and my roommate's dog and one of my dogs. We were just on the beach playing and having a great time. And Leo took thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures.
Uh-huh.
And then we did a few other sequences. And then he put the whole thing together. We did a few video sequences. He put it all together, and it turned out really, really nicely. And it's posted on YouTube. And there's a link to it from my site as well if you need it from there. But I think I'm really happy with the way the song turned out. And I think it sort of covers a philosophy of mine, which is, you know, that you really can't hang on to anything. You have to, you know, the line is let go of what you love because what loves you comes back. And I really do believe that you really have to just learn to let go of things.
Wonderful. This is a few years back. So is this Odin that you took to that beach?
No, actually, the video is new. So the dog in the video who looks like it could be Odin without a tail, is actually a new dog that I got a year and a half ago named Ginger. Very similar mix to what when Odin died, I didn't think I was ever going to replace him. Two Christmases ago, I made the mistake of deciding to take some dog toys to a local shelter. And then after dropping them off, I made the mistake of going to the back to the kennels. And Ginger was sitting there and did the same thing actually that Odin did, which I'm a sucker for, which was that she was sitting by the chain link fence of her kennel and just leaned up to it, just saying, just please touch me. And, you know, was completely gentle and calm. And it was around Christmas and I had company and I was taking care of a friend's dogs. And I said, okay, I can't do this right now. But I thought, all right, if she's still there in a few days, then I'll consider adopting her. And she was. And, she's absolutely adorable and very sweet. And so she, that was actually the day that the pictures were taken was her and Doc's very first day ever at the beach, which was a very interesting experience.
What a wonderful story. I love that story. And that's Ginger. I think we have a link to this at strictlycomedyradio.com, one of the YouTube videos. We have a link to a YouTube that it starts out with the ocean waves. That's the same video we're talking
about. That's what I'm talking about, yeah. So that's the song Let Go. And for those video that we did for it, if you watch the video closely, it's apparently dogs know how to fly.
Okay. I have to admit that because of the developments during the day, I listened to some of your music but did not have the time to watch that video except for the very opening scene with the waves, so I intend to watch that later.
You'll see at the end, and it's actually, I don't want to give too much away because it's sort of fun to watch, but Leo did it just sort of as a joke, and just a little clip. He sent it to me, and he said, "Well, but you know, look what can happen." And I won't tell you what it is. And I said, "You know what? I love that, and that is so perfect for the theme of this song. Let's keep it in, but just at the very end." So, you will have the answer to the question of can dogs fly.
I'm looking forward to it, folks. If you're not in our chat room, you can find out more about Barry by going to www.barrygold.com, and that's BarryGold.com. Or you can stop by strictlycomedyradio.com, and you'll find the link, all of Barry's links there to his MySpace page and to his website and to the video we're talking about. And he's just done a wonderful introduction to the track called Let Go. And Bob, if you would roll that far enough far as I'd love to hear. And it's called Let Go. Thank you. That's very good. I enjoyed all of the track that we've heard. And you do such a wide range, everything from almost gospel, almost Bob Dylan, to sort of a rockabilly sort of a thing going on. How would you describe the songs you do?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I didn't want to have to worry about. I listen to so many different things, and I love so many different artists for so many different reasons. And so I really decided that I just wanted to let each song come out however it came out and not worry about where it fit into the scheme of things. One of the advantages of working with amazing session musicians like I worked with is that they are completely flexible and know all kinds of really cool things, both that I know and sometimes that I don't know. And so as you're talking about the song and they hear my demo of it and the basic sort of feel of the song, then, you know, you kind of throw out ideas. And in this case, again, they took it in a much heavier direction than I certainly ever imagined I would hear myself on. But it worked really well for what the song was. And so I love it and was thrilled with it. I kind of feel, though, like what I do is more like something you would have heard in the 1970s in the peak of the singer-songwriter movement when, you know, James Taylor and Carole King. And it's not that I'm as mellow as they are, but the thing that I feel passionate about is the lyrics have to say something. The artists that I love the most in the world all are wonderful lyric writers. I mean, you know, and my favorite artists are, you know, U2 and Bruce Springsteen and Ricky Lee Jones and Lyle Lovett, and there's a whole variety. But the thing that they all have in common is that they write lyrics that actually have intelligence, that actually convey more than just, you know, a really surface sentiment.
Well said. What was it like working in Nashville? I see that you were a general manager of TRI Entertainment. What was that about, and who did you meet there? Did you meet some of these people like Toby Keith? And
absolutely. I worked with all of them. It was a really interesting time. I just kind of stumbled into working with Tim Riley, who was the owner of the company, for a Tim McGraw radio special. They were doing a live radio special for the album that had I Like It, I Love It on it. And I started working with him on that particular radio special because they were doing live broadcasts all over North America. And so he needed help to deal with clearing stations and things. And I had no experience in country radio whatsoever. But I'm a pretty fast learner, and I know a fair bit about a lot of things. So I just, you know, sort of picked up very quickly on what it was that he was doing and what he needed to have done, and he liked having me around. So we continued to work on a variety of things. And there was a whole range of services that he sold, if you will, to individual record labels. And Curb was certainly the biggest account that we worked with. And so, but Curb was a very successful label and is. They have, you know, Tim McGraw and Jody Messina and Leanne Rimes when she was first break. I mean, they still have her, but when Blue came out, we were involved in helping to, capture, the buzz that was happening with her at that point. So I met all of them. And it's one of those very interesting things. You know, Shania Twain, what we were doing with her was a very limited project. There are a thing called liners where, you know, when an artist says, hi, this is Shania Twain and you're listening to blah, 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 blah. Well, the reality is that they generally don't do that at each individual station. They do it in a studio for every station at one time, and then the station gets sent it in the mail or however. Now it's done digitally, but at the time it was actually a hard tape copy. And so she came in to do the liners and every artist does them. And some are better than others. The thing that I remember about her is she is more beautiful in person than she is in any picture you've seen of her, if you can imagine that. I mean,
wow.
She just absolutely glowed, but also was so professional. I mean, she got everything pretty much on the first take, including ones that, you know, tripped up everybody else. And, you know, it's like, is it Colorado or Colorado? And she knew all of that and got it perfectly right away. That was an amazing thing. The Tim McGraw experience was also really cool. That was just after his first baby was born. And so Faith was actually in the studio along with Tim, with Gracie. And the thing that was cool was that they were were playing songs from the CD recorded, but he decided that they were going to do some one or two live songs that they did on the road, and he actually sang an Elton John song, which at the time I had never heard him sing an Elton John song, and it was really amazing to me, because to be honest, I wasn't a big Tim McGraw fan, certainly as a vocalist. I didn't think that he was a very talented singer. But his cover of Tiny Dancer was actually what it was amazing. And I just sort of went,
Tim McGraw said Tiny Dancer? Wow.
I know. And I just sort of thought, wow, he really can sing. And it was just sort of, it was this eye-opening experience that I don't know whether it was a conscious decision on his part, but on his country records, he did whatever he had to do to make himself as country as he could be, even though his natural instincts were more towards the, you know, pop rock, 70s singer-songwriter-y Elton John kind of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. And again, you know, it was also, I mean, to watch him watching Faith holding their baby, he was so completely, totally in love with the two of them. It was just amazing to watch, and a really cool experience.
Well, I should think so, and how nice it is to hear a positive story about people actually being in love in show business.
Right, it's right. Almost, well, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
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 It was a wonderful time. It was, I mean, the strange thing was that at the same time as I was dealing with this company and ended up running it as we continued to grow dramatically, we hired a bunch more people and I just sort of took on an administrative role. At the same time as all that was happening, I also had my songwriting deal. And so looking back now, it's sort of like, how did I get all that stuff done? I had this really interesting but busy and chaotic day job, and yet I was also writing songs and getting demos done and dealing with all of that. It was sort of an interesting, looking back, it was a very interesting time. But, you know, I mean, I guess we get done whatever needs to get done, which I think is what happened.
Well, I get the general impression that in Nashville, as in most music industry professional, but the whole issue of being LGBT is kind of a non-issue, is it not? Or does it even come up? Is this sort of a,
one of the reasons that I left Nashville. I mean, you know, I have wonderful friends there who I adore, all of whom knew that I was gay. There was no question about it. But you could not be openly gay. My boss knew that I was gay. But most of our clients didn't know. It wasn't talked about. I don't think that the people that I dealt with on a day-to-day basis, I don't think that most of them would have cared. But there's certainly, you know, within the music industry, you know, certainly in the Christian music industry, which is obviously centered in Nashville as well, but the country industry as well, you know, it's one of those things where it's the good old boy network, and they just don't want to know about it. And it's very frustrating when, you know, people are judging you based on your sexuality. And obviously it happens every day, and it has happened for years. And that was actually one of the reasons why I decided to finally leave Nashville. As much as I enjoyed my life there and I loved my friends and loved many things about it, I sort of realized that, in a certain extent, I had kind of gone back into the closet to be able to survive there comfortably. And although it wasn't ever that I, you know, had to make a conscious decision to lie about who I was, but to not be able to be open about it, just started to weigh on me. And so I decided to come to California where, you know, really nobody cares. And in comparison, it really, once I got out here, I sort of realized, like, oh, wow, I really was, you know, holding back a part of myself. Again, it's not that in any day-to-day things that I'm doing something that is, you know, openly, overtly gay, but to not have to worry about making a comment about my boyfriend and, you know, and not have to change genders, not have to think about it, not have to change the topic, to, you know, just be able to be completely open is just so important. And, I still have lots of friends who live in Nashville who are still in the industry and are still having to sort of hide who they are. And I hate that for them, but on the other hand, you know, they love what they do and they're really good at what they do. And so the trade-off, I guess, for them is worth it. In the end, for me, it wasn't worth it, and I really decided that I really needed to not have to worry about that.
Well, Barry, I think all of us recognize that Nashville is the at least the center hub for country and Western music, but and you mentioned that it's also the hub for Christian or Christian pop or the new generation Christian. I guess I had never put that together. Do they use the same facilities and the same studios? In other words, do the groups commingle, or is it sort of a big line drawn between the two?
You know, it's really funny. When I lived there, there was very little commingling. It was, you know, two very different things, two very different worlds, and you know, there was virtually no connection between them whatsoever, both for songwriters, for musicians, for studios, for touring, everything. It was all completely separate. That has changed since I moved away. And so, for example, the musicians who played on my CD, who are, again, you know, A-list Christian musicians, but they also played on Rascal Flatts CDs. And so that's something that has changed, and I think it's studios, obviously, if it's a great sounding studio, it's a great sounding studio, regardless of what kind of music you're doing. Nashville has so many creative people and musicians and songwriters, singers, it's all there. And so it's very easy to get almost anything done there. The fun thing about it is, even when I lived there and had a writing deal, although I was signed with MCA Nashville, the fact of the matter is that I was never really a country songwriter. It's just I happen to write songs with lyrics that make sense, which, you know, is half of what makes a country song.
Well said. Yeah, go for it.
So when I would hire the musicians to do the demos way back then, even, they would love to come to my sessions because it would always be different than what they would do at most of their sessions. Because, you know, it's sort of the standard country song has the same chord progression and the same basic, you know, five different vibes, and it's one of those five, and it's almost by the numbers in a lot of ways musically. And that's not how I write, and so there's actually an expression among session musicians, and they'll say, you know, wow, there's an out-of-town chord in there. That's true, because it's, you know, when you get anything that's sort of outside of the normal flow of chord progressions, it doesn't happen that often, so it's an out-of-town chord.
You told us earlier about, you mentioned actually the track that you did for a New York musical called My American Dream, and you took it, and was it used in the musical, or did you take it and rewrite it for your album, Knocking on Another Door?
I wrote the musical and then didn't do anything with it. And when I only had a cassette copy of my demo of the show and hadn't listened to it in probably more than 10 years. And as I was going through the process of just uploading it to my computer so that I would have a digital copy just in case anything ever happened to the cassette version, I realized that there were a lot of things about quite a few of the songs that I really, really liked. And so with My American Dream, the concept was there, and that's something, you know, I mean, I have always been a sucker for sort of an all-American guy, and you know, that just is what it is, and that's, you know.
Somebody who likes baseball and
right.
Hot
summer. Exactly, and wears his wears a baseball hat backwards and drives a Jeep, and, you know, and I mean, it's, you know, the sort of whole stereotype. So in the musical, the song wasn't quite that. It wasn't about that particular thing. It was a slightly different concept. But I liked the basic musical flow of the song, and I liked a lot of lyrics. So I actually just sort of took to rewriting it. The introduction is the exact same as it was in the musical, and basically the chorus, as it is in my CD, didn't exist in the musical version. Because, of course, you know, when you're writing a musical for the stage, the most important thing is that the story gets moved along at all times. And, you know, you don't worry quite so much about having a chorus that's fun or singable. And so as I was working on the chorus for this song, I don't know why it was, but I just immediately in my head heard, ooh, ah, mmm. And, you know, sort of the whole gaggle of people all, you know, ooing over the same boy that I'm ooing over. And so that's what the song ended up being. And again, it was so much fun to do, and it is fun to sing live. And, my publicist, suggested that should be my first video, but we just didn't get it together in time just because it's such a perfectly suited to a video kind of song. Although what I actually think the concept may end up being is, you know, everybody's idea of what their American dream is everybody's idea is different. And, you know, the things, I mean, yes, there's an all-American look and style, but the reality is that a lot of different things go into making up the American dream. And so I think the video may end up, when we get around to doing it, may end up being about a whole variety of different people all showing what their dreams are, even if they're completely different from each other.
Well, this is fascinating that you actually wrote a musical. Was from beginning to end, was the plot boy meets boy, or was
I was living in New York. I was Canadian. I won a green card in the lottery, and so I moved to New York because I had a partner at the time who lived in Toronto, and I didn't want to break up with him, so I wanted to be relatively close. So I moved to New York, and we only lasted for 6 months, by the way. But since I was living there and I had some friends who were involved in the Broadway industry, if you will, and so I was talking with them and thought, okay, if I'm going to write a musical, I don't want to have to deal with coming up with an original story, because half the time that sort of is where things go wrong. And so I actually did a musical version of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Ah.
But set in contemporary New York. And so, I mean, it was the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream, but it was updated, and I actually still think it's a really cool idea, and I think there still is some potential to it, but again, you know, there's so much involved in putting together a Broadway show and so many other things, and, you know, I have to make some decisions about where my priorities are. And so in this particular case, I'm, you know, thrilled that I got this song and one other one that I updated as well, that I really enjoyed the experience and really liked the songs, and was happy to include them in the final CD.
Well, that's an amazing story, Mary. And the last thing I expected was it came from a musical that you wrote. And so let's run this for the listeners. It's Barry Gold, and it comes from his new CD called Knockin' on Another Door, which is available via Amazon or CD Baby, and I think even iTunes as of late. You can find out more about Barry at www.barrygold.com. That's BarryGold.com, as we were posting it in the chat room. And this track is called My American Dream. Roll it, Bob.
Practical and bold is this passion you inspire. earth but missing. Real but idealistic. Wholesome and good as a hometown parade. I'm a pile of wood and you're igniting the flame. Open your door and I'm begging for more. So please. You're all American. There's no comparison. I'm really digging to see. American, my all-American, you're my American dream. You're a Faulkner novel, you're a Pulitzer Prize, partly country cooking, partly Miami Vice. What art is sketching out the scenes of my life, and you're doing it for me. You're all-American. No comparison. I'm really digging to see. You're my American, my all-American. You're my American dream.
I love that song, and I really don't know how to explain this, but I'll just have to come right out here and try to get it across. I really like songs that talk about American this or American that are not all nuclear war and the army marching. Yeah, and there are a few that come to mind that I've heard over the years that they're rolling in the back of my head. I can't call the names, but it's really it. Well, I just like them. It's nice to hear something that's not militant that mentions the United States.
It's actually funny. I sang that at my club show in Vancouver and sort of felt a little sensitive and guilty to the fact that I was in Canada and I was born and raised in Canada. So I actually, the very last line, instead of singing my All-American, I sang my North American dream.
Well done. You know,
to be sensitive to that fact.
Yeah, people don't really always remember down here that Canada's part of North America.
Yeah, exactly. And, it's one of those things where, a lot of the songs that I assume you're referring to, you know, are sort of these flag-waving, country anthems that, you know.
Those are the ones.
The Toby Keith kind of stuff that just gets under my skin because it's like, you know what, there's an entire world out there that doesn't care. And, you know, I mean, I am so happy to be an American citizen, and I'm so happy that I live here, but the reality is that there are a lot of people around the world who don't care. And, to me, the song is about all the good things of being all American, and it's not at the exclusion of anything else. It's just, you know, these are the things of that I really like in somebody.
I think it's funny. Beautiful.
When I go back to Nashville, all of my friends know that I have to eat at Cracker Barrel several times if I can, which some people still have an issue with, but I never had that same issue. So that, you know, the very end, it's, you know, partly country cooking, and that's straight out of my love for Cracker Barrel.
Well, I think that's well done. It's America needs more non-militant songs, getting kind of old, got to tell you.
No kidding.
That whole shtick is getting a little old. I want to ask you about a track called Everyone Breaks Down Alone. Now, I did listen to that today, and it's a song about a flat tire, and God knows it's a touching song in so many ways. The flat tire is probably allegory. Tell us about Everyone Breaks Down Alone.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting thing. That's the only song in the entire CD that I didn't write by myself. And I've always generally written by myself, although I've co-written a lot, and they're just two very different processes. And I enjoy both, but writing alone is something that I tend to prefer to do just because it lets me sort of live with something and you dwell on it and you mull it over and you kind of make changes to things, and that's just sort of, it's the process that I like to have. But in this case, a Vancouver singer-songwriter who I had never met was coming to L.A. to live for a couple of months and do some co-writing and do some performance and a bunch of other things. And some of my Nashville friends actually put me in touch with him. They said, you really should meet this guy. He's really cool. He's interesting. He's fun to be hanging around with, and he doesn't know a lot of people in L.A., so you should meet him. So we got together. We had dinner. We were just hanging out. We were talking. And we both sort of said, you know what, we should get together and try to write, just, you know, see what happens. So he came over to my house, and he, at this point, he had been here, I want to say, for about 6 weeks. And we were talking about how, as big as L.A. is, everybody is alone and feels like they're alone half the time. And you know, you're sitting in your car, and you're surrounded by all these other cars, but you're completely alone. And it's really easy to feel that way. So what is actually the second verse of the song was what we started as our first verse. And we wrote a chorus, and then we sort of called it a night. And looking back at it, I liked the chorus and I liked the verse, but I didn't feel like they really went together very well. But I really liked the way I sounded when I sang just our rough work tape of the verse of the song. And so I thought, okay, let me see if I can work with that. So I wrote a new chorus for it, and I just felt like starting, I didn't want a song to really be about just about loneliness. And so I thought, okay, it just seems, you know, again, I'm a very positive, happy person most of the time, but like everybody, there are times where it just seems like everything's going wrong, and you just feel horribly alone at those moments, it seems like. I've had several car accidents and incidents in the course of my life. And, what happens in the first verse of the song isn't something that has actually happened to me, but, I have had a variety of things happen. And again, you really feel like you're completely alone in the world. And so, I thought it kind of tied in nicely that the chorus, which is about how, you know, everybody, when you are at your most vulnerable is when you feel the most alone, is ultimately what the point of the song is. The flat tire in the car is sort of one level of vulnerability. And then being in L.A., and one of my favorite lines in that song is in that second verse, where it says, out-of-state U-Hauls come packed up with hope, empty and broke.
Stars.
Because people are moving to L.A. every single day, and they all have the same dream, and whatever that dream is, even if it's not the same dream, it seems like it's the same dream. And at the same day that they're coming in, there's somebody else who's packing up, and because, you know, L.A. proved too much for the man. So it just seemed to all sort of tie together quite nicely. And then in the end, the sort of bridge part of the song, I thought, okay, I actually wanted it to be about, you know, the death of a parent or a spouse. And then I thought, okay, I don't want to have to set that much of a scene up. So I made it a little more generic, and, you know, the bridge is just, I miss you, I wish you could, whatever the lyrics are. But you're not here to see me. And so it's sort of, again, it ties up the whole idea that whatever the thing is that is getting to you the most, it seems like when you're at your lowest is when you feel the most alone, which, you know, I mean, is very unfortunate because I don't think that's really ever true, but when you're in the experience, it certainly feels like it is.
It becomes true. You're absolutely right. Well, this track is, again, folks, from Barry Gold's new CD called Knockin' on Another Door, available through Amazon and CD Baby and iTunes. This track is from the CD, and it's called Everyone Breaks Down Alone. Roll it, Bob.
Driving home a bit too fast, hungry, tired, and low on gas. suddenly my tire blows the horn. There's no cell reception, so I'm left to wait, stranded and hopeless and late. Time, time it is everything. Why is it everything's broken, worn out? Ain't that how life always goes? Everyone breaks down alone. Wandering these LA streets, everybody always seems by the dreams they've lost, wanting what they haven't got.
You know, your songs have such a wonderful melancholy often, and
You know, again, you know, it's one. I appreciate that. I really. There are times where I sort of try to deny that part of it, but the reality is that we all have those feelings and we all go through it, and so I just decided to embrace it.
Well, you did one heck of a job doing it, I have to tell you. What's the next page for Barry Gold?
Well,
what are you up to?
That's a really good question. And I had lunch with somebody the other day who was just starting their career in entertainment, and I said, you know, so what's your 5-year plan? And so we were finished talking about them. They said, so what's your 5-year plan? And I sort of went, I have no idea. At this point, I continue to hopefully get the word out there about the CD. MySpace obviously is a wonderful tool to help spread the word, and I have found, many people. I mean, I found Glenn through MySpace, or he found me through MySpace. It was sort of a mutual thing, I think. A number of people, around the world have discovered who I am and what I do and like it, and, you know, slowly but surely we're spreading the word. So that's part of the process. I have no immediate plans to do a whole lot more live performance, but I really do enjoy doing it and did enjoy the 2 Pride shows that I did, so I will probably do a few more occasional shows here and there. Yeah, just continue moving forward. You know, my hope and my expectation is that some of these songs will get put into movies and TV shows and used as they are, and that will help me to pay for the whatever comes next.
Well, I have
I haven't even started writing songs for that yet, and I sort of had this moment the other day where I thought, okay, I know that I need to be focusing on promoting the current one, but I also really need to start working on some new songs so that I have them available and in the can for whenever it's time to go ahead and start that. But that's quite a ways down the road.
Well, very certainly the track Everyone Breaks Down Alone is ripe for any number of movies that are that tone to it. You know, someone leaves another, someone dies, or it's really a very touching song, and wouldn't distract from a movie. It, in other words, doesn't call attention to itself, yet it stands alone as beautiful.
Right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, and that certainly was my intention and my hope, and you know, so far everybody that has heard it has been very positive, and I've had wonderful feedback, and so I really have this sort of realization that, you know, this is what I should have done 15 years ago. I don't really regret anything that I've done in my life, but there's a part of me that feels like, you know, why didn't I just do this 15 years ago? And you know, who knows? There are so many reasons why, but the timing seems to be right now. And like that song says, you know, timing is everything.
Barry, just out of curiosity, what part of California do you live?
I live in L.A.
I live in
North Hollywood. And, you know, I make money as a songwriter, but I don't make enough to live off of. So I actually have a day job. I work for a very famous studio, doing anti-piracy work, believe it or not, which is a very interesting thing. But you know, just basically at this point is just the way that I pay my bills so that I can do what I really love. And I'm very fortunate because my boss knows what my real passion is, and so she is very flexible with scheduling and timing and everything else. And so it really has been a wonderful time that I've had there that's allowed me to get to where I am now. And again, you know, certainly my hope is that somewhere down the line I will be able to do what I'm doing as a singer-songwriter completely full time again, which I have done in the past, but not recently. And you know, it's one of those things that I love the process of writing so much, and getting out the experiences that I've had into music that people then connect to is just such a wonderful feeling. You know, I will do it whether I'm paid to do it or not. I realized that a very long time ago, that it's, you know, a fundamental part of who I am and how I express what's happening in my life. By putting it down in songs, it helps me to process it. Which actually kind of ties into what I guess will probably be the last song that we can play tonight. And that's a song called Walking and Running, which is probably the gayest song on the CD, since there are a couple of lines in there that there's no mistaking. It's actually, there's a line in the song that says, "The waitress was a man," I think. When we were in the studio, I was singing just the scratch vocal, and these musicians, who again are, you know, mostly playing on Christian records, were all playing what they were doing, and we were in the groove and the vibe, and I sang that line, and they all just sort of, their heads popped off from looking down at their charts. It was sort of like, what? Did you just say what I think you just said? And it was a lot of fun. But again, it's interesting because that song, I mean, is, you know, is a lot of fun, and it's very light and fluffy, but it actually came from a breakup that I had with a guy that I had dated, and it was the first person I had dated in quite a while where I really felt passionate about, and he dumped me, and it just, you know, sent me into a sort of a tailspin. And the wonderful thing about being a songwriter is that I can take that experience and turn it into this really fun, light, fluffy sort of song, but that also, you know, reflects the reality that, hey, look, we all get dumped sometime, and it's just sort of a sad fact of life that, you know, it doesn't work out always the way you want it to.
Wonderful. Well, Barry, we are approaching the top of the hour, and we have another show coming up. So what we'll want to do is go ahead and run the track called Walking and Running, and we may have to fade it early, but if we have to fade it early, we will certainly play it in full tomorrow night, or the Yeah, tomorrow night will probably be a good night for it. And in closing, let me say that you're a wonderful guest. I have thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show, and thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, and good evening to you. Folks, that's Barry Gold, G-O-O-L-D, and we're going to go into the ending of the show with an additional track from his new CD, and it's called Walking and Running. That's his track called Walking and Running, Barry Gold, G-O-O-L-D. And we are rushing toward the end of the hour. There will be a horn section coming up. I'm so glad to have had you with us this evening. Good to be back. Here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.
Ask any musician. The best music happens when the sheet music gets put aside and the gang just sits down and jams. Same thing here on The Horn. America's best liberal talk hosts free-forming together for an hour a night. Welcome to The Horn Section. The best music happens when the sheet music gets put aside and the gang just sits down and jams. Same thing here on The Horn. America's best liberal talk hosts free-forming together for an hour a night. Welcome to the Horn Section.
All right, welcome to the land of the weird. Okay, let's see. This is the Horn Section. The Horn Section intro didn't run all the way through. And I think I'm being joined by my compadres now. John there? Peter there?
I'm here. Some other music come through for a second, but...
Oh, this is bizarre. I'm just hoping... But, hey, you're here. I'm here. We're here. Hallelujah. Praise God for small favors.
Oh, my God. Are you telling me we're, like, totally live?
Totally.
Oh, my God. Oh, what a nightmare. Bob, we got to get a disco-rated player. I think it's the BPM that's screwing that thing up.
It may very well be, but that doesn't explain why Lowell George and the Tower of Power just screwed up.
Oh, we're having a little, maybe they've gone right wing on us. The manufacturers may be contributing to the Republican Party.
Yeah, this is, the company's in Greece.
I'm at a loss, Bob. I'm at a loss.
I mean, I was sitting there, you know, I try not to stress the system too much or anything. I want everything to be all happy, happy, happy. And so I wait until I know we're getting close to, you know, the gay bar across the street. And I fire up the player and I go, to, you know, click the little button that says add file. Nothing happens. Add file, nothing happens. Add file, okay, it's not going to play in that. So I open another player. And it looks like it's opening, but it doesn't open. Meanwhile, I can't get back to the chat room. I keep clicking on, you know, Internet Explorer, Internet Explorer, Internet Explorer, nothing.
Well, that's your first mistake.
Oh, stop it. I mean, no mood for it.
So then John has a good point that if Internet Explorer failed, it's probably because of a hung applet within Internet Explorer, like, you know, what, Shockwave?
Yeah, but everything, but Peter, everything failed.
Oh, yeah, well, I was just thinking that if IE failed, then that applet may not affect, you know, what's the other one? Firefox may open, so you could always have it as a backup.
I may have to load it, with your permission, Peter.
Yes. I have it on my machine, too, because when you design a website, they don't look the same in Internet Explorer and Firefox, so you have to proof it in Firefox to be sure, because you can embarrass yourself in Firefox. If you only look at Internet Explorer,
it's more to be the point is Explorer does not follow W3C standards and everyone else does. So you design a website and it'll work in every other browser except for IE, where you need to make adjustments for IE. Just to give it to you from my angle as someone who does this every day.
Yeah, I keep it reversed in my head. I just, you know, I do everything Microsoft and all that, and so it's just my way of thinking. But yeah, you could compose to Firefox and then switch and then adjust.
I mean,
either way,
you have to go down both roads every time, and you know the folks who come together and create these standards do it for, you know, some pretty good reasons. And
you mean like uniformity, universality?
yeah.
Little C Catholic. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, for anyone who works with web stuff, you know, most of your styling is done with a thing called a style sheet. And it makes it so that you can change the whole look of a website by editing one file, and it'll change everything site-wide. And what you find when you design something that you have to add extra code specific for Explorer only. And this is one of those things of where Microsoft, for all the good that they've done, really thumbs their nose at the idea of an open source community.
There I have to completely agree with you, John. And they tried to steal, what is it, Java? They tried that, and they got busted and had to. And then what was the other stuff? They're always
trying to hijack. They tried to drive Netscape into the ground, and I guess largely succeeded.
They were largely succeeded. The only two real functional browsers are, what is it? Well, there's three if you count the Opera one. I don't know how well that one works, though.
Well, the Opera is supposed to be really wonderful. Safari for all platforms is really, really good. And all of these run off the same Gecko engine that Firefox and, you know, all of your open source browsers run on. So, you know, you're fairly well uniform. The other one that recently came into effect with Microsoft is they were found in breach of a university copyright for Flash player embeds and refused to pay for the rights to utilize it. And so some 2 years after the case was decided, a few months ago, suddenly no one's Flash embeds worked in IE because the way it was worked around is you have to actually add a whole other script just so Flash will work in IE. It's just such a mess.
You know, that's a classic example of that old gag about how many Microsoft engineers does it take to change a light bulb?
How many, I shudder to think.
None. Bill Gates just declares darkness the industry standard.
Oh, I have to agree. I have to agree. Well, I'm in a special boat of misery. The Strictly Confidential site, I had to get up and running very, very quickly. And the quickest way for me to do it was to use the Microsoft product called Publisher, which will also create. So it is, Strictly Confidential is full of all these Microsoft references, just absolutely full. And it does take some playing back and forth to get it to look right in both browsers. But
well, yeah, it's highly frustrating across the board. And the thing is, when you've got going on what I've got going on, you have no idea what's causing this, except for the fact that every time we have a problem, it seems to be associated to one degree or another with our automation player.
Yeah, but that is old. I don't know what to think about that. Something's stepping on its toes. I don't know what. Did you run it in 98 compatible mode tonight?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I did. And see, that's the thing. At least in theory, and John, you've played with it probably more than Peter has. At least in theory, this is great software. What it is for anybody who's ever worked in a radio station, it's a virtual cart deck. And it works pretty well. But this is the freeware version, because we have to beg and scrape and plead and cajole and to get, you know, less than 1% of the listeners to the horn to contribute to keeping the horn on the air.
Well, you know, the next big project we might have to do, unless we get a donated copy, is to forego buying another piece of hardware and just go ahead and buy that freaking Audition that costs $1,000 or whatever.
Well, that's what this is. No, I mean, the for-pay program you get for, I think, 700 euros.
Okay, euros mean I'm from the dirt road.
$1,000.
Okay. Okay, well, I guess that was close.
And so that, you know, that's, or, you know, find another piece of automation software. But, John, have you seen anything that meets our needs like this does when it's not screwing up?
I have never found anything that even remotely resembles what Jazzler does, even in other pay-for versions. It seems to be one of the only applications of its type available. I've found Jazzler, you know, way, 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 way back, even, you know, pre-Horn. And I wish I could figure out what the clash is, because I mean, with the usage that I've had of it, which I don't use it as much as I used to because I don't produce from here, I didn't have nearly as many crash issues, but then again, I'm not using it every day, so you know, the math on that doesn't necessarily add up. It is kind of frustrating. I sometimes wonder if some of the tricky things that we do with it, as far as the multiple sound card thing, has some sort of play, but that doesn't make any sense to me.
No, nor me.
And, well, and
but
you
by
know,
the, but by the way, the comedians are at work in the Horn chat room.
Oh, Lord, are they fake making fun of us? What are they?
Well, no, after I did the Bill Gates in the Darkness is the Industry Standard thing, somebody else came back as, how many Apple engineers does it take to change a light bulb?
What's the answer?
Only one. He puts the bulb in the socket and expects the world to revolve around him.
I'm sorry, but I think that's priceless. You know, it's the 21st century. It's 2000 freaking eight. Can't anything be standards? I mean,
I know. And can I throw this one out there?
Two ATM, you know, those pads at the grocery store. No two of them are alike.
Speaking of telephones, one of the things that we have to pay attention to here is, you know, once upon a time there was one telephone company in America, and they charged, you know, I've seen phone bills that my parents paid for, and my grandmother even, from the 1960s, and she was probably paying in 2008 dollars, she was probably paying $300 or $400 a month for telephone service when you work out what the long distance tolls were.
Oh yeah, long distance. You were not allowed to know anybody but local.
Yeah, but once upon a time there was one telephone service, and everybody pretty much had the same telephone. You could get it in black, or black.
Or princess.
Only you would mention the princess phones.
The princess phone was a huge leap forward.
Oh, it was, and it shows up at that. I don't know. Maybe its first film debut was perhaps Breakfast at Tiffany's. I don't know.
Was it? Yeah, I think it was, and there was.
And then the slim line came along, and you know, even my father was. I am not spending an extra $2 a month for touchtone service. The freaking phone company charged for push-button phones that whose tones were being generated by the rotary dialer in the first place.
I didn't know that clue. I didn't realize the rotary dialer was doing it.
So, I just want to throw this one out there, too. Can we please, all the creative code-writing the Jaspers out there, can they please start naming programs something normal?
Get them, Bob. Tell them.
I mean, can it be like Johnny's Browser?
Yeah.
You know, Unified Word Processing. Does everything have to be named something bizarre?
Something sad.
You know, I went out trying to find an open source movie editor, and I figured, you know, Shaka Zulu. Oh, God.
Yeah, and FileZilla.
Fedora and Ubuntu and I don't want a hat. I want an operating system.
Fedora, that's a good. I don't load half that stuff because if I can't tell from the name, you know, who needs it? Got along with that before.
Half
I
of this
it.
Stuff looks like it looks like programming that was written by malicious hackers in the third world.
Well, I keep trying to figure out. I've been having to get into learning secure shell access for the new server, and so I need a little application to connect that way, which is a way of getting at the root files of the server. And one of the two that's been recommended for Windows is a thing called PuTTY. And I'm like wondering, and it's spelled capital P small U, double capital T small Y. What does that mean? I have no idea. And what does it have to do with secure shell? I don't know.
And do I want something called PuTTY in my task?
Apache. Board? You know what do we what do we get next? Choctaw, Cherokee.
You made me snort. That's too funny.
Jesus, this is frustrating. I want the Sears. I want the Sears browser. I want the JCPenney browser.
You know, no, you don't. Really, no, you don't.
They're
Well, no, no. Yeah, I know.
We talk about when they're not listening. This is how we ran on when they're not listening.
And I don't want no Kmart browser because, after all, we've all seen Rain Man, and we know that Kmart sucks.
Yeah, Kmart sucks. Oh, that's perfect. He said that. Kmart sucks.
Oh,
well, when you first made the Microsoft joke about the light bulb, I was trying to figure out how you were going to how the punchline was coming around to him stealing the original technology of the light bulb and calling it his.
Yeah, there's that.
Which is the browser situation. I mean, that is the thing that galls me. I mean, I know we're really kind of going off on Microsoft here, but what galls me the most is, you know, the graphical visual web browser, which Firefox, i.e. all these things are. The very, very first one that ever existed was the original Netscape. So Microsoft goes and builds IE off of Netscape, and then somehow in the courts is able to convince the courts that they that Microsoft in fact created the visual browser that Microsoft owned the patent on. And so Netscape ended up folding under the judgment.
Way, way, way back when, John, when Peter was first explaining to me that it really was okay to take the side panel off a computer.
Bob, I can't believe we went through all that. We have come from primordial students.
Oh, it was like one of those old pot boilers from the 50s where the young pharmacist mate has to perform the appendectomy on the bobbing deck of the freighter in the middle of the Indian Ocean. It's okay, Sammy. Just cut his belly open.
Bob, take out the damn screws. It's not going to hurt anything. Just do it.
It's not going to blow up. It's not sabotaged.
Right, but I'm sitting there, okay, I'm taking this one out. Can I touch anything?
And I'm chewing on furniture.
And, you know, but it just shows what a marvelous teacher you are, Peter, because now, you know, fools rush in where angels fear to tread, and I'm head fool now. Ah,
well,
screw it, I'm pulling it.
Yeah. There's going to be many broken hearts and disappointments. Is it, won't it, John? I mean, you just can't. At no point do you ever actually get everything. It's impossible.
Oh, no, you don't. But no. There was the time that when, you know, if I felt like I had to take the side panel off the computer, you know, I'd rub myself down with Vaseline and stuff to make sure that there was no static electricity on my body.
Oh, Lord.
But here we are, and it's a lot of this is incredibly frustrating because you have no idea, and no amount of diagnostic can tell you where it's coming from.
Right, and it's not that we're incompetent. It's just that we don't have millions of dollars to buy all the stuff that, you know, that they use that we have to implement some way with rubber bands. What can I tell you? It's expensive to do a radio show. But we've done it, and I'm damn proud of us. I really am.
I am, too. And
you know, serious, eat my shorts.
No kidding. You know, and it's just astonishing to me to realize how far we've come, and yet I still get whacked on a Monday evening because the Rolaids fell off and hit the mixing board, and I don't have anything in my headphones, and like everything's going sideways, and I'm flipping out, and Agnes has to walk in and go, I bet it's this button.
You know, that's the best line I've heard of this show, or any of the shows, in a long time. Just you're doing Agnes with that Marilyn Monroe voice, just so characteristic of her. You gotta love her.
Is it
for
this
that
one?
You just want to kill her.
Here's your audio, Mr. Talk Show Host.
Oh, Lord. You won't be able to live with her for weeks.
Oh, but we had a nice little time last night. It was pleasant for her to be able to get out and see other adults because she has been in full bore grandma mode for so long now. I don't think she owns a single piece of clothing that the new little baby hasn't, you know, spit up some formula on. I keep going, use the towel. Remember when the babies were little? We used the towel. She says, I'm too old for towels now.
Bless your heart. Well, Bob, you get in a restaurant. You told me you had some sort of local spice thingy, which is very intriguing to me. I bet nobody knows about that except...
No, Nanette is going to giggle so big when we follow up with this.
Please tell. It was a great little story.
The first green thing that comes out in the spring in Appalachia is a wild-growing herb? No, not really. Root vegetable? Yeah, kind of. A wild root vegetable called ramps. And they are called ramps because the ancient Celtic word for garlic is ramseg. R-A-M-S-E-G-H, I think. Or R-A-M-C-H-L-Y-Z-K-L-E, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know how Welsh things are spelled.
It's intended to be dialect.
And you pronounce it Smith.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But ramps grow wild in the Appalachians, and we love them.
Is it like ultra garlic? Is it a bulb that grows under the ground?
It's not a bulb. It's usually just a straight little stalk. Maybe if you leave it long enough, it forms a bulb. I don't know. But it's a straight little oniony stalk with a little bit of like red onion color to the very base of it, and it comes up into a flat leaf that's maybe, an inch and a half wide. And it is like a cross between garlic and leeks. And in fact, not too far out the road from me is a place called Ramsey. And Ramsey is an old, old name that is taken from that other word, Ramsey, which means field of garlic. Which is why I giggle every time somebody plays that Sting song about fields of barley. We were howling down the road on a trip one time, and it's a beautiful song. I'm sure you've both heard it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Agnes just loves it, you know, makes her go all misty-eyed and stuff. And it's gorgeous. It's truly a gorgeous little ballad. And I look to her and I say, "And I'll walk with you in the fields of garlic." and that was one of those moments early in our relationship when she looked at me and said, "Why do you have to make everything into a joke?"
Because if I didn't, I'd go nuts.
And I just looked at her and said, "Because if I hadn't, you never would have married me." At which point she had to gear down and go, "Aww." But anyway, you know, it's ramp season, and last night at the restaurant, Jesus, this has turned into Prairie Freaking Home Companion, hasn't it? It was a brilliant little idea because ramps are frequently served with one of two things, beans or potatoes.
Beans.
Yeah, because usually by the time of year that the ramps came up, folks here in the hills either had beans left over from last year, you know, dry beans, yeah. or maybe their new potatoes were in and they were able to gravel up a pot of, you know, and wash them and dice them and fry them. So either beans or potatoes. And my meal came with two fried potato cakes that had ramps mixed into them. And they were heavenly. Now, bear in mind, you think garlic is strong, or you think a wild onion is strong, or something like that. You ain't seen strong till you've been around a ramp. There was an old guy who ran a sort of community newspaper that was just revered in this state. His name was Jim Comstock, and it was called the West Virginia Hillbilly, and there was nothing like it. He has long since gone on to his maker. Once upon a time, he had tons of out-of-state readers, and just to give his out-of-state readers a little dose of home, he dumped a little vial of ramp juice into his printer's ink, and mailed his newspaper out all over the world as usual, and he got a nasty gram from the United States Postal Service that he said he would never forget. They said one page of the paper was enough to foul about 500 pounds of the United States mail. And that if he ever tried such a stunt again, they would sick the FBI on him for sending poisonous material through the mail and revoke his mailing privilege forever. No appeals, no nothing. Goodbye.
Well, you know, Bob, this makes me think of Vidalia, Georgia. You know, they made a huge name for themselves with the Vidalia onions, and they're very good. How about Appalachian ramps?
I don't think you can cultivate them. Nanette might be able to tell us more about that. She may be off feeding her puppy right now. But I don't think you can cultivate them. You just got to go into the hills at the very beginning of spring because they're the first green things that come up through the frost. And you know, you pull them gently and get them up by their little root stalks, and they come up every year. They're perennials.
Well, there's already a market for it. Seppo's already saying he wants some.
Yeah, Nanette's there. She says, nope, you can't cultivate them. But I adore them. I've made, I took a classic leek soup, creamy leek soup recipe, and made them with ramps. And see, you know how garlic's got a little bit of a spiciness to it? I mean, it'll burn on your tongue.
Yeah.
A ramp will torch your taste buds.
Mmm, something like a combination of horseradish and garlic, is it?
You could even maybe say that, but it's much more of an oniony, garlicky affair. But you can get really creative with them. But they're only around for a very short time, and then they're gone. And Nanette's right; they're very, very picky about where they grow. They don't just happen. They're magic. They are. Hill folks, genuine, you know, raised in the hills people, have this schedule of things that they go after. Ramps come first, and then about a month and a half later, you go into the woods and you find your morel mushrooms. And holy smoke, you have oh my God, those things are, what a delight a morel is.
I have a story about magic. I'm looking at it right now. It was emailed to me the very last minute of Strictly Confidential, and it is about the Congo. And there is a huge panic in the Congo of penis theft. And in fact, the police in the Congo have arrested 13 sorcerers accused of using black magic to steal or shrink men's penises after a wave of panic and attempted lynchings triggered the alleged witchcraft. Now, reports of penis snatching are not uncommon in West Africa. Where are the belief?
Invasion of the penis snatchers. No one admitted after the first 5 minutes.
Now the
knob nabbers.
Oh, that's good.
The rumors of the penis theft began circulating last week in the capital of 8 million people and quickly dominated. Are you ready for this? It quickly dominated all the radio college shows. Can you imagine our listeners calling in to tell us that their pee-pee shrank and that the listeners have been advised to beware of fellow passengers in taxis who are wearing gold rings. And they're saying that the reason that they're shrinking their pee-pees is so that they can bribe them. They have to pay them money to get their Johnson back. Depending upon how bad
we are, so in the wrong business.
Depending on how much juju they put your way,
contribute to the horn or your Johnson will shrink. That's it, okay?
Right. It could either shrink or just plain disappear. And,
okay. The Viagra people have to be behind this. I mean, they got to be looking for some other way to advertise as opposed from, you know, spamming me.
I mean,
hi.
You know.
I am lonely. Would you like to chat? Are you worried about your size? Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I get 19 dozen of those every day. And it's really started to affect my sense of security. Oh, speaking of which, God, are we done with shrinking penises?
Well, only one more paragraph.
Okay, go ahead.
It's real. It's real, said. It is real, says one of the people. It just happened here yesterday. There was a man who was a victim, and we saw it. And what was left was tiny. Said the 29-year-old.
What does he do? Drop it. What does he do? Drop trow and they play the Jeopardy theme while it disappears? Shrinking penis. There it goes.
Oh, the journeys and stories of the American or the world of the PP.
Oh, Lord.
To amaze me. Just thought I'd point that out. Thank you, Frozy, for that article.
The News Ninja Gene finds things that are on the web that...
He's horrifying, isn't it? You just never know. You have to read his alerts because there's always something in there that you go, how the hell?
Well, I opened prayer meeting this evening with something he sent me.
Did you? Well, I'm sorry, I missed the very beginning.
Oh, you know, this is audio that deserves to be heard twice. Honest to God, it really is.
Oh, the preacher. I missed most of that. Yes, if you're going to run that audio from preacher, I'd love to hear it.
John, are you did you get this from Gene, too?
I may have missed this with all the stuff that I was going through, because he also sends me, you know, pounds of green stuff in my email all the time.
This is a real, live, honest-to-Jesus, fundamentalist American minister who is, and of course you got to understand when you're a fundy, you can't read anything but the King James Bible.
Of course not. Jesus said it. He meant it.
Jesus spoke Elizabethan English.
Queen.
And so did his daddy. And so did Moses. And Adam and Eve. And Elizabethan English all the way through. No matter how bad the translation is. So we'll just take a little dose of this, because it actually works in with what you were talking about with the shrinking, you know.
Shrinking Johnson.
They call me Shrinking Johnson. So just sit back and relax and enjoy, John.
I'm going to close with one thing. I was reading my Bible this week, and I kept seeing this phrase jump out at me in the Bible. And you're not going to like this, but you haven't liked the sermon up till now, so why would I try and please you now? You're going to be mad no matter what I say. But I was reading the Bible, and I kept seeing this phrase, and I studied this phrase in the Bible. It's used 6 times, and it's used by God. It's used out of the mouth of God. And it's when the prophet is preaching to the king of Israel, Jehu, and he says, Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and he says, "Thus saith the Lord." He said, "I will destroy from Jeroboam, him that pisseth against the wall." Have you ever seen that phrase in the Bible? Put up your hand. Him that pisseth against the wall. You see that in the Bible. It's used 6 times in the Bible. And it's, you know, 6 is a significant number in the Bible. It's the number of a man. You know, there are different numbers that represent different things in the Bible. Like 7 is the number of completion, you know. 5 is the number of death. And you see that all throughout the Bible. People being killed under their 5th rib. Genesis 5:5, Acts 5:5, on and on.
48, 29, 13, and 12 is the number of the lottery.
I see different numbers and significance of numbers, and the 6 times this phrase is used in the Bible, and you say, "Oh, I can't believe you speak that way, it's vile." I'm sorry, but the Bible says that the words of Jesus Christ are wholesome words, and the Bible says every word of God is pure. And so don't accuse me of using bad language. That's what the Bible says.
But it's not the words of Jesus Christ, of course. This is Old Testament crap about, you know, going pee-pee on the wall.
He said, "I will destroy him that pisseth against the wall." Now, do you ever stop and think, what did God mean by that? Did he mean, well, I don't know, what did he mean?
Seems pretty clear to me, doesn't it, you?
What if you built a wall that was just for pissing? Is that okay?
No. And you can't piss against the dumpster either.
Okay.
But it goes into this. I'm just fast-forwarding a little bit, because he obsesses about... Now, on the one hand, God says he's going to, you know, destroy those who do. But on the other hand, by the time this guy gets finished with it, it's probably a stoning offense if you let a stream go while you're doing the other, you know. But I'm not going to get any more graphic than that.
I want him to release a gangster rap translation of the Bible.
That would be fun.
Because right there he just said, you know, wholesome words. So if we're taking the words of men and claiming that they're divine written words from God when that has been translated, if we have a gangster rap or, say, a Chicago Mafia translation, then we can disband the FCC laws against the brown words, wouldn't we?
One would think. So just see where he goes with this real quick.
And I was there for 3.5 months. They had a sign in people's house. They had a sign in the public restroom.
He's talking about being in Germany, by the way, John. He says that this, what he's describing is factual in Germany, okay? So listen, this is, okay. He was in Germany.
In Germany, several different people's houses. I mean, totally different people. And even in public places, they had a sign that prohibited a man from peeing standing up. I'm not kidding. I mean, you can ask my wife is from Germany, and I was there for 3.5 months. They had a sign in people's house, they had a sign in the public restroom that prohibited, and I'm not going to, you know, it was like a circle and a line through it, and it's no peeing standing up. And I asked my wife, I said, is that like, I thought it was a joke. It's like, is that a joke? It's kind of a crude joke. She said, it's not a joke. She said, no man in Germany pees standing up. That's where we're headed in this country, my friend.
That's where we're headed in this country. No man can pee standing up.
Well, you know, I mean, he actually is right with that whole thing with there being signage about sitting down to pee. Now, you know, I lived in Germany for a while, and this is something that, you know, I have to say, you know, I was kind of like going, oh, this is new and different. But, you know, the whole reason is for hygiene, especially in public restrooms. It's for hygiene.
Oh,
and cutting down on the splatter factor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So real men actually in many parts of Europe sit down to pee. It has nothing to do with some bizarre Bible reference.
Well, see, that proves how far you are from the salvation of God. Just wait a minute.
Yeah, as a heathen, I know.
Yeah, just wait.
You
see,
don't go to hell.
The brother's going to explain it to us.
We got a bunch of pastors who pee sitting down. We got a bunch of, and you say, oh, you know, you're being vile. I'm not, hey, then God's being vile. God's the one that wrote the Bible, my friend. We got pastors who pee sitting down. We got the President of the United States probably pee sitting down. We got a bunch of preachers. We got a bunch of leaders who don't stand up and piss against the wall like a man.
But God said if you piss against the wall, he's going to kill you.
Well, not peeing standing up puts a huge crimp in golden showers.
Go stand in the corner, Peter.
I'm being punished.
Although you got to admit that would put a crimp in a hot happening Saturday night among the fundamentalists. If I take that testing you were referencing during your program correctly.
Ooh, not the dreaded penile stress test.
I don't even want to think about one. It makes me feel like I've been around a Nigerian penis shrinker. But yeah, but this is the kind of stuff that's out there. You know, children were sitting listening to this. Children were listening to this. My God. So let me, if you don't mind, let me segue into what I promised would be coming our way during the horn section. Today, my son, the sixth grader, was subjected to the sex education class. One day, everything you ever needed to know about sex, move on, son, nothing else to see here. One day. Fundamentalists are, of course, allowed to keep their children home when they're hearing about the dirty human body. No kidding, it's a matter of law. So, you know, they had their sex ed class, and Ferg's telling me, you know, what went on, and he said, Dad, it was kind of hard not to laugh. And I said, believe me, son, I get it.
Gotta love that boy.
He said, Dad, they showed us pictures of erect penises. And I said, and you giggled a little bit, didn't you? He said, no, Dad. I said, oh. He said, I giggled a lot. So he shared with us, they were given a true-false quiz at the end of the program. And, bless his heart, my boy got 100 on it. Smart kid, that Ferg.
I cannot believe you're telling me what? The American Family Association would be livid if they knew they were showing peepees in class.
But they did. And I'm not sure but what they even used the word condom a couple of times. Clearly, this is out of bounds for abstinence education. But this is largely a matter of biology. I'm just going to share the questions with you. True or false, guys? Sperm and semen are the same thing.
Well, semen have a ship.
Oh, Jesus. How did I know?
It's going to take you a while to get through this, Bob.
Yeah, I know. I know. We may not be able to get through it all. Okay, so Ferg got it right. False. Number two. The hormone testosterone causes a boy's voice to deepen. True. Three. And bear in mind, the girls were getting a similar class in a segregated situation. Because we can't have the boys learning how the girls' insides work, and we can't have the girls learning how the boys' insides work.
That's because it's for your wedding night.
Oh, and that makes me want to tell the joke about the guy who's dropping it. No, no, no. And then the punchline is, oh, I see you also suffered from smallpox as a child. Number three, the hormone testosterone causes hair to grow on the body, face, and pubic area. My poor son had to sit through the word pubic today.
True.
Four, the testicles are very delicate and should be supported during sports activities. And he looks at me and says, I'm sorry, Dad, but I just kept thinking of fans in the stands saying, go testicles!
I love that child.
I'm so proud of my children.
Please give him a show.
Oh, but it gets better. My daughter, Margie, now she's in eighth grade, and I guess she got the master class or something. She brings home, you know, they all had to draw a picture about something that they learned in sex ed. And she she chose as her topic the statement, August has the highest number of births. And she drew like nine doctors holding nine babies standing in front of a brunette woman sitting with her legs crossed saying, "Hi, I'm August."
Oh, Lord have mercy. That's
bad. I don't think I've ever been prouder.
Yeah, exactly. August puts out.
Okay. Number five, it is possible for semen and urine to mix together and pass from the body at the same time. False, oddly enough. In light of what we just heard from the fundamentalist minister, God would probably kill them if it did. And someone needs to pass this test along to the folks from the story you just read, Peter. Number six, the shrinking of testicles in cold weather is not a cause for concern. True. Number seven, an erection occurs when blood vessels in the penis are filled with an extra supply of blood. True. Looks like Ferg was picking up all the stuff. Number eight, ejaculation can occur when there is a buildup of excess seminal fluid. Yeah. Number nine, a boy's breasts can get bigger and become sore during puberty. Which is apparently also true, and I just don't want to deal with it.
I didn't know that.
Thank you, KFC.
Yeah, no kidding. A boy's breast can become larger from eating phytoestrogens from soy-based products that are laced with in our food supply. Never mind. Men usually stop producing semen when they're around 60. False. Ben Franklin proved that. And, you know, some of this is really important because there's a lot of misinformation that gets passed around. What was it, a couple of weeks ago I was talking about the Florida survey where, the boys were telling girls that if they took a shot of Mountain Dew before sex, they wouldn't get pregnant. And the Florida survey, Florida teenagers thought that drinking bleach would prevent HIV transmission.
Oh my God, how many esophaguses were destroyed?
Yeah, it's terrifying. Number 11, boys who have pimples or acne have more male hormones than other boys. False.
Oh.
Maybe a worse diet. Yeah, number 12, during puberty, a boy's shoulders broaden and he begins to grow taller. And when I saw that, I thought of the opening ballad from The Life of Brian. And he became a teenager called Brian.
Well, listen, isn't baldness caused by excessive testosterone?
It is. Dihydrotestosterone.
I had heard that, but I wasn't sure.
13.
Oh, that's what's causing the bare spot in the back of my head.
Yep.
No
doubt.
Now.
You're entirely too manly, John.
You need to cut that out, John. You get your hair back.
Let's see. 13. Circumcision is an operation that removes the foreskin of the penis. Yes.
By force.
By force. Right. Yeah. From little boys who have no say in the matter. Right.
Right. You know, I was thinking about that today, Bob, as a matter of fact. It's like they do this to you when you're a little baby, and then they never mention it. For your whole life, it's like this guilt thing. They never, I mean, you know, it's just, they, parents just don't talk. It's just like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like.
And then when your kid gets a little older and decides to go off to the piercing shop, they think that that's weird, but yet what they did to you when you were, you know.
Yeah, that's genital mutilation.
What was it?
Oh, yeah, good point, Bob. That's what I call circumcision.
Yeah. Let's see. Now, number 14. And this is tough. Number 14. Nocturnal emissions are caused by eating too much fried food.
I could have sworn it was from listening to too much disco, but
well, then again, I know some redneck guys who probably do have wet dreams over fried shrimp, so, you know.
Poor John, he's hysterical.
John had to leave the room. He's like giggling very distant.
I'm trying to let you finish, but you know.
You just want me to finish, don't you, John? Let's see. Number 15, new thoughts and feelings accompany the physical changes of puberty.
Do you think?
Oh, let me count the ways. Number 16, the size of a boy's penis determines how masculine he will be, and of course, Ferg marked that false because, you know, he was related to me. Number 17, sexual excitement can cause body odor. True.
Is it really? Because you sweat and that's it, or is this a different body odor?
Which explains why I haven't had to use deodorant for like 20 years now. No, I'm
kidding.
where's the rim shot
Agnes
when we need it, John?
I was just going to say, Agnes is obviously like out of arm's reach.
Yeah,
you say.
And out of throwing distance of the mason jar.
John, you got to start a rock group. You got to start a rock group called Nocturnal Emissions.
Oh, that would have to be a punk band.
Sure, John can pull it off. He knows the people.
Well, kind of close. The biggest Aboriginal heavy metal band is just known as Nocturnal.
There you go.
Maybe try and get them to do a side project.
Or name an album Emissions. Nocturnal Emissions. Let's see. The voice deepens when the larynx voice box gets larger and the vocal cords get longer. True. Boys continue to grow until they're 20 years old. True. There's a little bit of a disappointing sidebar to that, but, you know, I didn't feel like explaining it. Number 20, at puberty, a boy is capable of becoming a father. All too true. Glad he got that one right. And number 21, and this is sort of inexplicable. Remember, this is a true-false quiz, but everything is offered as a factual statement, right? And you have to check the box, true or false. Number 21, if a boy has a high voice, it means he is a homosexual.
You're kidding. You're kidding.
That's the last question on the quiz.
Oh. Well,
that's a shame. I was wondering how they're going to fit that in. That almost negates the whole AFA objection to the whole thing, you know, as long as there's a question like that in there, AFA would probably ignore it.
Now, bear in mind, Ferg marked it correct. He marked false. But there are three boxes, true, false, and don't know.
Was it the only one with don't know?
No, they've all got don't know, but he got it right. But how many other kids, how many other, the giggling little threshold pubescent boys went,
there you go.
Yeah, I think so. That's what my old man said when he was beating the snot out of me for being a fag. You know what I mean? You remember the guy in Florida who killed his 5-year-old?
Because they thought his 5-year-old was too feminine for him. He beat to death a 5-year-old because he thought he was too feminine. God in heaven help us.
And how many little boys took this test home and their old man looked at it and said,
Well, see, you marked that false there, that number 21. It is true. Them boys with high voices and queer. You know, I think it's almost like the teaching unit is uncomfortable about what it's teaching. You see what I'm saying? Because there are things that need to be said that leave no room for doubt. And that's one of them. Does that make sense?
And having this don't know option, you know, allows certain people to say, well, I know it ain't true, but I'm going to mark don't know because I'd prefer to believe.
Well, there's that and there's a high voice. And there's the fact that by including don't know in there, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think any of the kids who sat through this actually get a grade on it. You can't be graded on your knowledge of human sexuality.
Well, you know what puzzles me here is I seriously doubt it was ever taught in class that a high or low voice indicated orientation. So this had to be a best guess question. I thought it.
I don't know. I'll have to ask Ferg about that last one. But you know, he came home and that was the first one he showed us. He said, "I can't believe they put that on there." He said, "There were people checking yes."
That's a worry.
And we have to, you know, and you got to understand, at least in this state and so many others, there has been an absolute war to even get that much instruction into the curriculum.
Lord have mercy.
Boy, has it changed since, you know, I was in high school, because, you know, we at that time did a pretty, I have to say, pretty good sex education thing. I can't remember if we were segregated or not, just to limit the giggle factor a little bit, but I remember being, you know, taught pretty clearly about, you know, how the biology works, how you protect yourself, da 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 da. And it was very, you know, we were kind of told that, you know, religious beliefs and morality will not be taught here because this isn't the place for that.
But you grew up in civilized New Jersey.
Well, I have a feeling that things have probably changed because, I mean, it was the beginning of the Reagan Revolution at that time, and the changes hadn't really come, you know, full circle quite yet. You know, saw other parts of it, you know, the just kind of cutting of school budgets and things like that. But, yeah, you know, I wouldn't think at that time anyone would even dream of putting a question like that on the test. And that bothers me in just so many unbelievable ways.
Well, I'm sorry to have wasted so much time on it, but I was actually quite fascinated by it. And I was determined to use the fried shrimp line, by the way.
When you got one, you just can't keep it.
I will go miles for a punchline.
Lord.
Well, Peter, thanks for sticking around after your show. Thanks for telling us about the... Now I'm all worried. What if they're right?
Well, there could be a Mountain Juju woman just chanting right now.
Probably
could
is.
Be.
I'm gonna have to. I'll have to make the like sort of preemptive excuse to Agnes, honey. There's magic out there. There's a right wing voodoo priestess right now.
That may be what. No, that's not a joke. I'm not going there. Mm-mm.
Yeah. Well, there's another joke. The punchline where the newlyweds on a wedding night and. Oh, it's just like a only smaller. How did our little family friendly network get this way? I'll never know.
Just outright friendliness.
Yeah.
No BS. You know, we just tell it like it is. That, you know, roll with it, or, you know, or that's just the way we is.
Yeah, just shake it off. You know. Jesus help me.
But that means you're standing up.
No.
And lo, saith the Lord, I will kill all the men what pee upon the dumpster.
Thou shalt not pee against the wall drunken with kebab in hand.
Is that what they're calling it these days?
Now, I'm talking about the lamb sandwich that every drunk goes and gets, you know, after the bars have closed here.
You know, you can see the cruiser with the spotlight pulling up to the, you know, the old wino by the dump. Stop! You are in violation of John 3:16.
Oh, and he turns around and looks at you and goes, violate this.
I got your violation right here.
So funny. That is the theocracy we're headed for. You're in violation of some particular Bible verse.
Well, we've done it to another hour. And we've really been all over the board on this one, haven't we, guys? I mean, we started out complaining about our computer woes.
Yeah, I think we covered everything.
Well, sweet dreams to you, Peter.
Thank you. Yes, I'm old and tired. I'm asleep. I love you guys.
No, we love you too.
Good night, mate.
All right, and you're on the way. You're around the corner, John.
Get him, John.
All right.
All right. So, in closing, if the automation software works, here's the late great Lowell George reminding you to.
This is a top to you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most
11,
of the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is that any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to
11. 11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody. Welcome aboard Foxed Up for, well, one, the one show of the week. Oh, well, things happen. Oh, there's been so much going on. And, you know, I got a backlog of music, most of it from David, but I'm sorry, mate. It ends up getting pushed off another day, but I think you'll understand. We're going to do some music for Mr. Isaac Hayes today because, well, I'm sorry, we lost a huge one. And a master of production. You know, I'm not going to say too much. The music speaks for itself, and, you know, a whole other generation got to know him, you know, as chef in South Park, and we have some of that as well. and, you know, when I first found out that he had been found, next to his treadmill machine or whatever, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who, you know, still works in the music business, and he said, "See? Exercise, it'll kill you every time." And I said, yeah, that'd be right. The only part I couldn't understand with him was the Scientology thing, but hey, you got to forgive people for things sometimes. I unfortunately only have actually a best of his, so I went through there and grabbed a couple of things. And the first one, I just reckon is such a great example of his use of production. And the one thing about his production that I always got a sense of is you always felt the room that they were in, and that the room could handle a certain amount of energy, and his amazing use of, I don't know, not using that energy as use of dynamics, and you could just kind of hear the room breathing in the background. Probably has something to do with the era of most of the recordings, but this one, I just, because it just holds back the restraint shown in the arrangement, I just think is amazing. So Mr. Isaac Hayes, "By the Time I Get to Phoenix." Roll it, Bob.
I'm talking about the power of love now. I'm going to tell you what love can do. You know when they say love makes the world go round, that's the truth. Now I want your imagination. I want you to travel with me. Oh, come on, come on, come on. This young man was raised in the hills of Tennessee. When he reached the age of maturity, he moved to the West Coast. And he fell in love when he got out there to this young girl. And then the inevitable became engaged and they were married. Oh, the power of love was upon him. But you see, girls, I don't mean to come down on you. But this man loved this woman so he could see no wrong, no, no, no. He spent his last dime on a woman because he loved her. You know, girls, you can take love and kindness sometimes for weakness. And she took it for granted. And she tripped out on it. She ain't nobody gonna believe what to tell him no way. Fool. Oh, yeah, girls, you like that sometimes. But one day, old boy got sick, and he had to come home. I don't have to tell you what he found. Oh, it hurt him so bad. He said, "Baby, Mama, all he could say." But she said, "Oh, go on, fool, you doing it." But the man wasn't doing it, but that's the only excuse she could give him. He said, "Mama, I can't take it. I got to leave you. I'm going to leave you." Well, she tried to straighten up. She said she was going to straighten up. She got a little job to help him out with the bills, too. But that was just a sham. Because he found it again. And again, and seven times he left this woman. And seven times he came back.
And he had taken all that he could stand. And the eighth time that this went down, he said, Mom, I got to go. He said, I'm leaving my heart right here. And he was going down the highway. I guess it was around 3:30 in the morning. He could hardly see the road, the tears in his eyes. He could barely see the sign, the red on the side of the road. The next town, 125 miles away. And these very words came into his mind. By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. Oh, and she'll find a note I left hanging on the door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. Yes, she will. Why? 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before. Oh, by the time she'll probably stop at lunch just to give her sweet goodbye a call. Oh, she'll hear all the phone. She ran on ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing for a ringing off the wall. Mama, 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 that's all. And by the time I get to Oklahoma, she'll be sleeping. She'll turn softly in her restless sleep. Call my name. Just to think I would really leave. But time after time after time after time and time again, I tried to tell her so. But she was a non-believer. I would really go. Oh no, I hate to leave you, baby. Yes, I do. I really, really, really hate to go. Oh yeah, but this part of my...
Talk about, you know, just sounding like it was expensive. In the chat room, ELO mentions a very story that I had for today. And, you know, we've spoken about this before, and, you know, David from Maine made a comment saying, oh, is it just rehashing old news? But I don't actually agree with that. We've talked about the dead zones in various parts of the world's oceans before, and, you know, we keep hearing about it because it continues to happen, and it's continuing to get worse. And, you know, just because it's, you know, might be considered in some ways old news doesn't mean that the damage still isn't happening, which is still current news. So I don't see it as just rehashing content. Because this is a huge problem, you know, and again, it comes down to our use of fertilizers, mostly. But at livescience.com, and I do agree with David, though, that the New York Times should credit where they get some of their stuff from, when they take it from places like Live Science. You know, and this is just another study, again, just reaffirming what we have known for a while. Parts of the world's oceans are running low on oxygen, a new study finds. Like, I've read a bunch of articles that have started with that very statement. Fertilizers and other chemical pollutants in river runoff fuel blooms of algae that cause oxygen levels to dip when they die. A review of research into the so-called dead zones detailed in the August 15th issue of the journal Science finds that the number of dead zones has roughly doubled every decade since the 1960s. The study authors Robert Diaz and Virginia Institute of Maine Science and Rutger Rosenberg of the United States, the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, tallied 405 dead zones in coastal waters worldwide today, affecting about 95,000 square miles of ocean, an area about the size of New Zealand. While that may seem small compared to the total coverage of the oceans, the local effects can be devastating to marine ecosystems. These dead zones occur when fertilizer runoffs dump excess nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus into coastal waters, providing food for algae. When these microscopic plants die and sink into the ocean bottom, bacteria feed on them and subsequently consume all the oxygen dissolved in their water. And so, you know, this ends up happening, you know, down, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico and whatnot, and it's just hugely bad. You know, there's no fish to be fished, because there's not enough oxygen to support life. You get to this point where it only supports as much of this microorganism down at the bottom as it possibly can, and it stays there. So, I mean, this is a continuing problem, and, you know, this is a perfect example of where, you know, for those that might even doubt some of the science behind global warming, if we do what the environmental community says, is it necessarily a bad thing? Even if there are some inaccuracies. And so, you know, if we stopped using chemical fertilizers, which really, if you rotate crops and do things properly and not try and just get these ridiculous yields out of it, we wouldn't be creating this damage. And you cannot tell me that undoing the damage wouldn't make up for, you know, any profit loss. In the horn section, we were speaking of carbon tax cap and trade systems. You know, it's everybody's responsibility to take care of the whole thing. So, you know, this is just another one of those examples. You know, if we go to better forms of farming instead of this chemical based stuff, we would have more organic matter to actually absorb carbon, for one. That's actually a major gain. But we wouldn't be having these runoff problems like we do now. And we wouldn't be using Monsanto Franken food seeds, but that's a whole other story. But we're going to get back to some music here. And we couldn't cover Mr. Hayes if we didn't go here, because we just have to go here. I can't believe I couldn't find the CD, so I ripped this off of YouTube, and it seemed to be a pretty good copy. So Isaac Hayes as Chef. Doing chocolate salty balls, or salty chocolate balls, all depending on, I've seen it listed both ways. So this is Isaac Hayes as Chef from the South Park film. Roll it, Bob.
cinnamon and two or three egg whites, a half a stick of butter melted. Stick it all in a bowl, baby. Stir it with a wooden spoon. Mix in a cup of flour. You'll be in heaven soon. Say, everybody, have you seen my balls? They're big and salty and brown. If you ever need a quick pick-me-up, just stick my balls in your mouth. Ooh, suck on my chocolate salted balls. Stick them in your mouth and suck them. Suck on my chocolate salted balls. They're packed full of vitamins and good for you. So suck on my balls. Want a cup of unsweetened chocolate and a half a cup of brandy. Then throw in a bag or two of sugar and just a pinch of vanilla. Read up the cookie sheet, 'cause I hate when my balls kick. Then preheat the oven to 350 and give the spoon a lick. Say, everybody, have you seen my balls? They're big and salty and brown. If you ever need a quick pick me up, just stick my balls in your mouth. Suck on my chocolate salted balls. Put them in your mouth and suck them. Suck on my chocolate salted balls. They're packed full of goodness, high in fiber. Suck on my balls. Hey, wait a minute. What's that smell? It smells like something burning. Well, that don't confront me none. As long as I get my rent paid on Friday. Baby, you better get back in the kitchen. 'Cause I got a sneaking suspicion. Oh, man, baby. Baby, you just burned my balls! My balls on fire! Salted balls. Put them in your mouth and suck them. They're on fire, baby. Suck all my chocolate salted balls. Put them out, baby. Blow them. Oh. Suck all my balls, baby. Suck all my balls, baby. Suck all my red hot salted, salted balls. Come on, baby. Woo! Woo! Suck all my balls.
That's just silly. Anyway, we lost a good one, Isaac Hayes. Yes, I gotta agree with ELO. You know, I he did lose me a bit with the Scientology thing, but hey, you know, he did have enough of a sense of humor to do South Park in the first place. So, you know, hey, what are you gonna do? We're gonna go to the phones, and we got a couple people waiting, but we'll go to Gene first. Our news ninja, Gene. How you going, mate?
I haven't heard that in forever. That was great. Well, the reason I called in is we were talking about the bees and the monetary businesses and such. I got a chance, you know, when I went to the peak oil meeting to see the 11th hour.
And right.
There was a statistic in there that basically said if we charge for all that nature does for us now for free, it would end up about $35 trillion.
Sweet.
And it's like, and it's weird because just last week I had, I think I sent you this article about the human bees in China. They had people painting pollen onto the trees there because there weren't enough bees and things to pollinate.
I mean, it's a massive thing if, we lose bees. I mean, I just I can't emphasize it enough. For food alone, it's unbelievably huge. And I think what you're saying there is, you know, we have to actually put the dollar value on actually, you know, Mother Nature and the planet and the resources that it provides us, and include that into the equation and actually, you know, assert some value to it, which we don't at the moment.
Well, at this point, I'm so paranoid anymore with everything that is going on. I'm almost, I hate to say this, but I'm almost paranoid to think enough that maybe that was the idea all along. So basically, if we killed off nature enough, the business would have to take over and charge us all for, you know, what we did.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
That's a little far-fetched.
No, and, you know, I mean, I try and speak all positive about, you know, the fact that we're having discussions here about a carbon trade system and, you know, actually coming up with targets. However, you know, while I say that, I should actually say that, you know, there's plenty of time for them to completely screw this up, right?
Yeah.
You know, they can, you know, I'm hoping that they get something that they can build on. But it has as much the potential to turn into something that's just a complete joke and ends up giving the industries that should least be given it free rein. And it could end up being horrible, and I'll be screaming up and down about that, you know, in 2 years' time.
Well,
but, you know...
Go ahead.
You know, so, I mean, we just have to kind of wait and see here at the moment. But, you know, it's amazing, you know... Here I'm thinking, you know, we're finally going to start putting together this policy, and then you realize that, you know, the other side is not going to come to the table and be part of it. They're just going to play ante because it's all that they've got, and now this thing's yet again being used as a political football. And you know, I forgot that there would be this, like, you know, the last stand for the Alamo kind of thing.
Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead, mate.
Well, I was going to say, I would hope they wouldn't be this stupid to look at it like a money-making point, because I trust nature to keep doing what it's supposed to be doing. I don't trust humankind to be that regular. And with that, I'll let you go to your next caller. But, you know, that statistic of $35 trillion, I think, a year. I think.
Easy. It would have to be easy. That, you know, I mean, you look at any plant, and you realize that, you know, if you burn down a tree, and the pile of ash that would be left behind would be all that actually came from the ground, and the rest of that tree had actually been built by sunlight. And you just have to realize what an unbelievable undertaking that is. And that happens, you know, it happens time and time again all over this planet. And we don't see the value or see the wonder and amazement in that.
Yeah.
I think that's missing the point just grotesquely.
Definitely. And I'll catch you later.
All right, mate. Thanks, Gene.
Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you soon. And that was our news ninja Gene, who sent me actually a whole bunch of the stuff that we've got for tonight. But before we do that, can't play homage to someone like Isaac Hayes without having David ring in. How you going, David? Welcome to the program.
Good evening, John. Long time no talk yet.
Yeah. you know, it's been one of those runs lately. What can I say?
What can I do
for you?
Well, you know, I was just going to speak on Isaac Hayes. You know, people need to realize, they always forget, John, they always forget, but they need to realize that Isaac Hayes, when he became a solo star, that happened by accident. Accident. Wasn't meant to be a solo artist. Wasn't planned. He was always going to be a staff writer at Stax.
Right.
I mean, Hayes, and I'll give it up to David Porter. David Porter, one of the greatest lyricists of all time. Isaac Hayes wrote the music, kind of like the same setup of like Bird Bacharach and Hal David same kind of legendary catalog that they had. They wrote for Carla Thomas, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, and they did 85% or 70% of the work of Sam and Dave. So that right there, people, that right there put Isaac in legend category, game over. He could have left the game. He could have said, I'm done. I demolished all of you. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But he didn't do that, see? What happened next is just the talk of legends. What happened next was, go ahead.
No. I mean, I always think of him as just an amazing arranger, producer. Just, you know, that's always been the tying line. You know, just has a really good sense of that was always my impression. Everything that he ever did, you know, and even like the Sam and Dave stuff, you know, there was always a real sense of space in everything. And it's actually something that you don't hear very much anymore, and it's purely because of the way technology has infiltrated the process. And you know, it sounded, you know, it was an orchestra in a proper recording room, you know, just really organic and just gorgeous production. Just really gorgeous production.
I would say
yet over the top, really over the top sometimes.
I would say he was Mozart of soul. He ushered in the Romantic era, the epic symphonic soul. And another thing that a lot of people don't realize is the fact that when he came out on the scene, if you saw the visuals of what he did, the fact that what was groundbreaking about him on the visual side was he took the chains aspect of slavery, and when he wore those chains, that was the aspect of he's free now.
Yeah.
He had that lineage in his parents.
For people who thought that Mr. T came up with that whole thing, no, Mr. T got it from Isaac Hayes, probably.
Yeah, probably Isaac Hayes. And like I said, I have pretty much his entire catalog. Tell you what, John, one of these days you're going to have to play his version of Fragile. I'll have to send it to you. Well, actually, I don't have to send it to you because I already sent it to you.
I have to just go and get it.
Go ahead.
You're just making me think of something else now, but I would like to play that. Have you heard, since I have you, about this young 21-year-old Australian bass player that Jeff Beck is cruising around with at the moment?
Tal Wilkenfeld. She's amazing.
Oh, my word. She slid under my radar, and Gail stumbled across her the other day. Now, folks, you know, I mean, we're talking Jeff Beck here. We're talking, you know, up on the level of God. And this guy has been touring lately not even with a bass player. He's preferred a keyboard player who could play bass on keyboards. And then pops up, I saw footage of, it's Tal and, is it Vinny Caliuta? No. But one of those drummers that played on Steely Dan's Asia. Just in trio. No. It wasn't Gad.
Clinic drummers. Just say that. Clinic drummer.
Yeah. One of them guys.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm just sitting there looking at this, you know, like 21-year-old girl who dropped out of school at like 14 with these teeny little hands just running rampant on that instrument. She's going to be someone to watch. And I went and checked out some of the tracks on her solo album that she did when she was the ripe age of 20.
Yeah.
And it's frightening jazz. Unbelievable. Oh.
She's an amazing talent. I'll send you that quick.
I just sat there and you know, Scott and I always joke that Jeff Beck is actually the archetype for Nigel in Spinal Tap.
You know what? I think Christopher Guest He did say that in an interview. He's a hybrid of that, a juxtaposition as well. The other part of Nigel is Ron Wood, without a doubt.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
You know, just going back to Isaac Hayes, we talked about the music, but now we can talk about the conspiracy. Yeah, my own.
Okay, you say that now.
I'm serious,
Don. Am I right to understand that he was in the early workings of a film with Bernie Mac, and they die within like 3 days of each other?
Oh yeah, but here's the conspiracy. That's not the conspiracy. The conspiracy is, the rumor is, the gossip is, because I don't know it to be true. But if I listen, people, if I read it on the internet, it must be true, right? So apparently Isaac Hayes had gone back to Matt Stone in tears, saying, "Listen, guys, listen. I wanted to be on the show as much as I could, but they made me quit." Now, notice he said they made me.
Right. Okay.
He said they made me quit. He was crying, literally crying, and they just couldn't believe it. They didn't know what to do. But he had made his bed and he lied in it. But you know, it does point to something that people don't think about, which is when you said the treadmill. I thought you were going to go there, so I'll jump in there. When you said the treadmill, Isaac Hayes died on his treadmill. Now here's where it gets. It was where you can connect things. If you know anything about Scientologists, you know they have monitors around them 24/7.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
He was on his treadmill. When the paramedics got there, guess what? The monitors weren't around.
Ah.
No one's talking anything about it. Now am I saying, in case we have some Scientologist stalkers out there, am I saying that the Xenu worshippers killed him by neglecting to help him? No, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, where the F were you guys?
With minders like these, who needs enemies?
Exactly.
I actually hadn't heard that bit. It was just when I read in one of the early pieces after Hayes went, saying, you know, and his friend, you know, Bernie Mac, who they were working on this film Soul Man, who died kind of surprisingly young.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, oh, this could be fuel for something. But I didn't hear. I never actually heard anyone make any actual connection behind it. But yeah, there's always room for a Scientology, you know, scare there.
Of course. But the truth is, John, that those guys were literally in his finances and in his accounts. So I'm not saying that the Scientologists helped kill him with the stress that he had to pay these guys constantly. I'm not saying that, but what I am saying is it is rather odd the fact that he was on a treadmill, he slumped over on the treadmill, had the heart attack, and the monitors weren't around, and no one can account for where they were. My feeling is if something did go down, and they knew Isaac was going to make some noise about Scientology in the future, they were going to walk away, John. They weren't going to help.
You know, I can definitely see where you know your brain can go there, because there has been some weird crap when it comes to the Scientology people. And a few days ago down here, they were airing some Oprah special with Tom Cruise's return, not jumping up and down on a lounge, and I was looking at him for a minute, and I'm just going, something just does not look right with that guy anymore. Something in his eyes, he looks kind of gray. I mean, is that higher level thing where you actually turn into an alien?
You know, John, the thing about that is when I was actually over at my parents' house, and I was watching, my mom was like, "You gotta see Oprah! Tom Cruise is on!" And I was like, "I don't think so, this is garbage." And she was like, no, watch him. And I watched him, and I watched how she interacted with Oprah, and when the questions of Scientology came out, he was screaming inside, "Help me, get me out of here, take your film crew with me in a way, with me and Katie Holmes, and our baby, we need to get out of here." Because here's what I think, John. Well, that's not actually what I think. It's a pretty good guess. They're in his bank accounts right now as we speak. They're probably like Scrooge McDuck, you know. They're in the money bin and they're swimming around like a duck
and they're doing heavy math at the moment because Universal has just dumped his production partner.
Well, you know, John, I keep saying these Scientologists are some of the most dangerous people, and someone brought up the point, why would Isaac Hayes go with that? Well, I'll tell you a very simple reason why Isaac Hayes went with that. It was tragedy in his life. It was a lot of downturns in his life. And when you're in that low period, those people can literally light you up if nobody else is around.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No doubt. But that's classic with any kind of cult situation. I mean, regardless of what breed it is, that's what they feed on.
Look what
they feed on people.
Look what they're doing to Will Smith.
Are they playing with him too? They got him already.
They already got him building a school for him.
He's actually one of the few kind of pop culture people that I actually kind of like, and they have to go and fucking bend him too.
Now, if you really want to get conspiracy, what were his movies about?
He's got a lot of alien stuff in there. Oh yeah,
right.
There's a lot of alien stuff in there.
Independence Day was about evil aliens.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying.
Men in Black.
Saying.
Okay, I'm following you here.
Yeah. I'm saying to people that this is the problem. This is the cancer. Beck is in the same boat. Not Jeff Beck, the other Beck.
Yeah. Beck.
Yeah, he's in the same boat. He won't talk about it either. A lot of people are saying...
Beck, my mom's a CEO. I was just going to say, Beck, my mom's a Sony CEO.
Oh, is she? I didn't know that.
I think it was one of the labels that got bought up by CBS. Might have been Epic or something. But yeah, he's like offspring or relative of Sony personnel.
Oh.
He's no accident. I like him. I got no problem with him, actually. You know, I mean, I like him for what he does. It's cool. But,
I like Beck for one simple reason. He hired Roger Manning in his keyboard from the Jelly. That's
there's
for me to like him.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I mean, he had connects, and I'm not actually using that to take away from him, but he had more connects than people realized.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was, I don't know if you heard about this, but the original steel guitar player of Hank Williams' band died. Hank Helms.
Oh, no way!
Yeah.
He must have been getting on.
Yeah, he was seriously, I think he was like 81 or something. One last thing before I get out of here and you get to your stories. Did you catch the news on the Obama jet?
I saw headlines. I didn't actually read the stories. Was this about the scare?
Apparently, now if you want to talk conspiracies, we can talk conspiracies. Apparently, the Obama jet that they gave him was Hillary's old plane. Whoever set that up. Now, Clinton supporters, don't get mad at me. I'm not saying anything. Just like the Scientologist thing, I'm not saying.
I couldn't even go there and jest. I really, you know, I might have my disagreements with Hillary Clinton, but I couldn't in a million years
think that, you know.
I mean, I can hang with the best of them, but sorry,
I'm not saying it was the Clintons. What I'm saying is whoever gave him that jet that has faulty problems, I look into that person's background. Just saying.
Oh, yeah.
Last thing is that there's a new movie coming out September 20th. It's called Battle in Seattle. It's about the World Trade Organization's riots in 1999. Andre 3000 stars in it. Check this cast. Andre 3000, Ray Liotta, Michelle Rodriguez, and directed and written by Stuart Townsend. So if you get a chance, check the trailer. I think it'd be a...
Yeah, I've known about this film coming up. I knew about this thing being in production. It should be really good because, you know, there sure wasn't coverage like there could have been during all that. I'm curious about that film. Thanks for that, man.
Well, John, until next time, that's all I got for this evening.
All right, buddy. Thanks for that, man. And take care of yourself. And that's our good friend David from Maine. And Bob just sent me a link from Think Progress. And he said, get ready to scream. And, you know, what now? And this is just the lunacy that we've got to get past. I mean, this is just outright stupidity. Limbaugh, U.S. should consume energy like Michael Phelps consumes food. This coming from a big, fat, drug-addled lunatic. Yesterday, press reports revealed that Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps consumes a 12,000-calorie-per-day diet, six times the average calorie intake of a 23-year-old man. On his radio show today, Rush Limbaugh said that since extra energy helped produce excellence in Phelps, drilling for more oil would do the same for the U.S. Oh, fuck's sake. But now we read that Michael Phelps is burning and using... But now we read that Michael Phelps is burning and using 12,000 calories a day. While the Democrats are trying to alert everybody to the dangers posed by energy, the Democrats and left are now demonizing oil. They're demonizing our own ability to be energy independent. They don't want us to be able to get our own independent sources of oil or natural gas. Yet look at Michael Phelps. Oh, Bob has the audio. Please, Bob, let's just give everybody the ability to absorb Rush's fat ass and vomit all over their keyboards. Go ahead, run it, please.
I know, ladies and gentlemen, achievers use more energy. High achievers, high producers use a lot of energy, and I have said so with pride. But now we read that Michael Phelps, burning using 12,000 calories a day, while the Democrats are trying to alert everybody to the dangers posed by energy. The Democrats and left are now demonizing oil. They're demonizing our own ability to be energy independent. They don't want us to be able to get our own independent sources of oil or natural gas. And yet, look at Michael Phelps. No citizen of the world, he couldn't care less at those little Chinese gymnasts or rice cakes. He's out there saking up more than his fair share, more than he needs. This is pure gluttony. This is typical in the world of Obama of what the United States has become. See, ladies and gentlemen, American consumption, when it results in exceptionalism in athletics, why, that's perfectly fine. Why, that's, we celebrate that kind of consumption. American consumption for the greatest production and the greatest reward, why, that is fine if we do this in sports. However, if we consume and produce exceptionalism in goods and services for others, including ourselves, then somehow we are committing a sin.
Now, notice some of the language that this asshole uses. You know, they're demonizing oil. They're demonizing our own ability to be energy independent. As though the ability to be energy independent is completely tied up in oil and natural gas, which is complete and utter bollocks. Now, you know, consume, the more you consume, what a bunch of shit. Now, Mr. Phelps also happens to get a hell of a lot out of that 12,000 calories a day. He's using it efficiently. There's something represented in the output by his input. That is not where we are at as a country or as a world when it comes to resource use. I mean, all these guys who, you know, talk about the power of the markets and all this other crap, how is it that they're able to turn a complete blind eye to the fact that their supply of this stuff is dwindling? You should be looking to find ways to get off of a supply that's dwindling. But no, we just want to continue to ride our ideological horse to oblivion. What a bunch of shit. You know, and to have that fat bastard sit there and try and, you know, equate this position of excellence and all that and relate that to an elite athlete, which that fat piece of shit is about as far as you can get away from an elite athlete. I mean, I don't even care about the damn games. I mean, we're talking food energy as opposed to, you know, digging crap out of the ground that's killing us as fast as we burn it. What a moron. What a moron. Speaking of the Olympics, let's see. I don't know if you've heard, but an Australian reporter was detained for filming a protest in Beijing. He was had his passport taken away. He wasn't there to cover the protest. He just happened to be there as part of the media, and a protest broke out, as they do. And it seems as though the police over there haven't gotten the message that it's supposed to be an open Olympics, you see. So they're no surprise saying one thing, doing another. And I've been seeing a couple of threads around. One was at the Huffington Post. One was at Crooks and Liars. Dealing with shock horror, NBC's lying to us, and live events are being broadcast 15 hours after they happened, and we're being told it's live. You gullible bunch of morons. You're just catching on to this now. And I'm laughing. I'm just thinking it's absolutely hysterical. And where some folks are saying, hey, you know, the Canadian Broadcasting Company has like 5 channels running, so you can see like everything. You know, not this like insane control thing that NBC's got. And NBC's doing everything they can to like fight every clip from YouTube. I mean, it's just a joke. I mean, you talk about, you know, just fighting a losing battle in this modern day and age. The idea that you can realistically expect no footage from an international event to end up viewable on the web. as though you're going to keep it, you know, quiet for 15 hours to, you know, when people can find out the results anywhere. I mean, I keep thinking that, you know, this is just such a sign of how stupid the media really think that we all are. And if they're willing to do this with something like an Olympics, what makes you think that, you know, they're not just going to be completely... having a brain meltdown. I just keep thinking of Rush. What an asshole. I mean, seriously, what an asshole. It amazes me that we can still have people standing up there and saying that gluttonous consumption is something to be admired. And to be able to take a thing where, a situation where a guy has busted his ass for years to get to the elite level that he's at, it hasn't been driven by consumption. It's been driven by really hard work. And then he had to up the fuel supply. I mean, this is along the lines of the McCain camp attacking Obama for the inflating your tires thing. I still think about that, how, you know, every motoring group is saying, yeah, we could save 3%. Just like that. Bang. If everybody had their tires inflated properly. You know? All those NASCAR dads, hello, cars. NASCAR will tell you the same thing. But yet, little twist, little turn, little spin. Suddenly. Oh, trying to actually be safe and not waste is somehow stupid and uncool or un-American. I do not understand that. I would think the idea of greatness would come from maybe producing more with less. Just because you produce doesn't mean that it justifies your use. You know, really great example. Okay, here's one of those things that drives me crazy. Right, banks constantly talk about, you know, they advertise their products, and I'm sorry, a bank does not produce a damn thing. It doesn't produce anything. But actually, I did figure out what they produce. They produce a whole hell of a lot of waste and trash. I signed up for, I won't name the bank as of yet, but I signed up for a thing called an e-banking account. Thinking, you know, low fees, e-banking, internet banking, low paper. No, let's see. I got my little welcome booklet today. For a bank account that's supposed to be all electronic, I got 9 stapled books about my account. Now, I applied for this thing paperlessly. If this is considered good, if this is considered, I mean, I have a stack that's all going to end up in the recycling bin within a week. If that's the idea of, you know, excellence, sorry, I don't buy it. Anyway, time to wrap it up as my brain falls apart. Blah. See, you can tell it's brain poison. Rush is brain poison. I hear Rush and my brain just kind of turns to liquid shit. But thanks for being here today, folks. This is a short week, a one-day week, but we will do better next week. Thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for the streaming and the archives and everything that he does. Thanks to Scott Barry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. Thanks to Dave and Gene for ringing in. Thanks to Gene and the rest of the News Ninjas and our bloggers and our mods for everything that they do for us. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you next week.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I stuck my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, you look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do. So I took off my hat, I said, imagine that. Me working for you. Shot on sight. So I jumped on the fence and I yelled at the house, hey, what gives you the right? Put up a fence to keep me out, or to keep Mother Nature in. If God was here, he'd tell you to your face, man, you're some kind of sinner. Membership card to get inside.
Talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. Coming to you live from the Guy James Show studios. And we hope to have an interesting program for you today. And, of course, it'll be more interesting
If you contribute as well, and you can do that by giving us a call at 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. Love to hear from you today. Of course, we will be talking about politics today. Seems like we talk about politics every day, don't we? Well, it's what's in the news now, so we will talk about it a lot today. There is much to talk about. God, this Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac thing is amazing, and I see that Sarah Palin's comments on it prove she doesn't know Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac from a Big Mac. He evidently has not been prepared to talk about any of these things, and we'll talk a lot about Sarah Palin today. I just can't get past the fact that that John McCain's made such a decision. It's been on my mind almost constantly since she was announced as the VP for them. And so we will talk about that a lot today. Because really and truly, if you want to know how I really feel about it, nothing has ever proven my point about the American public being so utterly stupid than this hubbub over Sarah Palin, and that she's being accepted by millions of women who know there's no there is just flat out stunning to me. A 20% bounce in the women's vote, and I just, oh my God, I can't get over it. I really can't. But we'll get to that soon enough today. I didn't want to talk about it, and thank God we're being spared here. I see they're talking on the chat room, Texas Betsy. I hope you're not in the path of that, Betsy. But this Storm Ike, it appeared for a while it'd be going to be coming at us here, but it's changed course and kind of headed for Texas now. And we, other than getting a little bit of rain from some outer bands, a little bit of wind, we're not getting anything here in Southwest Florida. So once again, we've dodged one of these bullets, and I'm grateful for that. Very grateful for that. But in the meantime, we're being robbed by the federal government once again, and so what's new about that? Talking about debt for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, this debt and what's happening with this whole mess, their fat cat leaders bailing out with millions of dollars. What, one of them, $14.8 million in a bonus clause for running a company into the ground. Isn't that great? What happens to you if you work over at Walmart or JCPenney's or down at the local hardware store? What happens to you if you really screw up your job? Just mess it up completely. You don't do your work. All the employees in the place is screwing up, and the place is filthy, and you're not making any sales, and just basically losing in small business hundreds of thousands of dollars. Do you get a big bonus when they fire you? Is that how that works? I tell you. So, but it's debt that we're talking about, basically, with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and Republicans love debt. They need us to be in debt. And so now the fat cats who got rich when things were going really well over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they won't have to worry because the American public will end up paying off their massive losses. And I don't know. I think I broke my calculator last night. I was trying to figure out some of this. It seems to me that this thing, again, it's one of those things where they privatize the profits and socializing the losses. And isn't that just the way that the neocon Republicans like it? When there are massive profits, we take all we can. Get it, you know, take, grab, get. Greed. Take it, get it. But when things go bad, oh no, you see, this is integral to the good, you know, to the good standing of the United States. We've got to have this. We've got to throw public money in there. I mean, we've got to. We've got to, otherwise we'll go down the tube. Never mind that we raked off billions and billions and billions in profits before when things are going all right, but gee whiz, you can't expect us to absorb losses, can you? I mean, we put money in this to always make money. We didn't gamble and buy stock in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to ever lose money. Sure, you understand that. Of course we made a little profit. Of course, that's what it's all about. But surely you're not going to make us lose money on our stock and why, no, that wouldn't be right. That's not the Republican way of doing things. Just not the way. So we'll end up paying off their losses. And I'm still trying to figure out how this squares with the Republican mantra of the market will take care of itself. How many times have you heard that in the past few decades? The market will take care of itself. Of course it doesn't square with what they've said, but it sure does fit nicely with their practice of telling the public one thing and then doing another. They don't know how to do it any other way. And it also fits nicely with my contention that Republican conservative voters are among the dumbest people on the face of the earth for actually voting for the politicians who are picking their pockets while telling them all about the evils of Roe v. Wade and the goodness of family values. Vote for us and we'll get rid of that Roe v. Wade and we've got family values. You know, imagine for a moment, and I have imagined this, well, imagine for a moment what would have happened if Bill Clinton had asked the feds to take over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I mean, oh my God. There'd have been more hubbub over that than there was Monica Lewinsky. There would have been 24/7 hell to pay in the media, and you know I'm right. And there would have been extra editions of newspapers on the corner. Extra, extra. Read all about it. Bill Clinton takes over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The world's coming to an end. It would have been, you know, they had special bulletins all night long, breaking news on the major TV channels and the right-wing talk show idiots would have had friggin' coronaries over this. And they would have convinced the public that the Democrats had done this all by themselves. The Democrats had run it into